a fairly crowded agenda this evening, so we want to get through this as quickly as possible, but not to, you know, allow expediency to impinge on some of the very thoughtful discussions that we need to begin this evening. I will begin where we ended our last committee on Wednesday, and that is, you know, kind of the time for the talking is over and the time for building and moving forward is upon us, and that time is now. But before we get to that, however, we continue to reformat our principles, and I will have committee staff Rip Berkovian go through these principles. We're not scheduled for a work session tonight. We didn't get that on the agenda, so we will just go through the principles. Those that were a consensus principles from the Senate Commission, and then some additions that are on the principles for further consideration that are on the right-hand side of the page.
Thank you, Chair. And I won't read these, but just to review again, the on the first page there are the principles 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 5, 6, 7. I'm sorry, on the back. We did have some external feedback. Some people who have been following this made some suggestions. Those are again on the table to the right. We did add some language. The Developmental Disability Coalition requested that some language be added to the principles to reflect that whatever Oregon does in terms of comprehensive health care reform also embrace people with disabilities. So if you go to principle number 3 and look at the right-hand column with where it says revised external feedback, the last sentence that says these services must address and meet the needs of special populations, including persons with disabilities, chronic conditions, and other vulnerable populations, that is brand new. So even though we in the last few meetings given out copies of the principles, that one line is newly added language. So I think what we'll be looking for on Monday is to not have a side-by-side anymore, that if there's any language on the right that committee members feel needs to be incorporated into the final draft, we can do that and then review it on Wednesday to kind of vote on a single draft of principles.
Mr. Chair? Can I comment on that? The item in 3 really makes me think that sometimes principles relate to the practicality of it and sometimes they don't. I mean, it would be interesting to see, looking at 3 with and without that last sentence, when we actually tried to design a plan. So the question is, would we want to accept certain of these things as a principle? That would mean we had agreed to automatically fix them into the nature of a plan we designed, when I think sometimes the practicality of where we are might make a difference. I'd be a little reluctant to accept principles. Not that that's a bad principle, but it's just an example that we might say when we were actually designing a plan, well, this may be a little beyond us.
Well, I would follow up. Pretty much echoing your remarks, the I think that specific inclusions of specific populations, DD, vulnerable populations, you start enumerating specific conditions, specific populations, I think at some level flies a little bit in the face of the overall guiding star of all of the principles, which is universal coverage and access. And it doesn't mean unlimited access for unlimited health care. It means we have universal access to a benefit that we all, at the end of the day, end up agreeing on. Is that where you're going, Mitch?
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going. I mean, for example, we might have a universal access program that looks one way and have a separate program for dealing with some particular special vulnerable populations. I mean, you could imagine a variety of ways to deal with it. And once you establish a principle, then you test all the design elements when you start getting into them against all the principles. So I'd be a little cautious about some of the principles before we actually start saying what's possible to do for 3.5 million Oregonians.
No, I understand, and I appreciate Rick highlighting what are good, heartfelt suggestions to improve what will become our principles. Any other comments regarding the principles?
Mr. Chair, just to reiterate, this is going to be something we're going to try to have a work session on the next
right.
meeting, right?
Which means that's got to be scheduled.
Yep.
So,
let's get it done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't here for some of the earlier discussions of these, but I would just point out that on Principle 4, the right-hand column reads to me as a decidedly different principle than the left-hand column. I just think it's worth noting that that's a, I don't know if you want to talk about which we prefer, but they seem very different.
Well, we've got you this so you can make those observations and we can discuss them in detail on Wednesday, but I think your observation is absolutely correct.
What I would suggest, Mr. Chair, is that I'll record these and we'll attempt then to craft a final draft based on your input if you have some things to send along later, because I think Senator Morris made that same observation too about that particular principle. And then we'll have a final draft to show on Wednesday for final adoption.
Very good. All right, now we get into the fun spot, the fun part. And I don't know if Rick wants to go down to the dais to help lead us through this. Dr. Bates and I are going to comment on what several of us at this dais and a good many other hardworking, committed Oregonians worked on over the last 6 months and put together a slideshow. You can see it on the board there, a slideshow of the basic conceptual tenets of Senate Bill 329. We see this very much as a starting point and a straw man. I don't want to diminish the work that's been done. These aren't just pretty colors and lines that showed up on a page yesterday. As I indicated, there's been a great deal of effort and work put into the establishment of this basic plan. And so let's just back it up and start with number one, and I'll let Alan take off on, unless you have some other comments with regard
just,
to.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair, if I could. This is a possible framework. I think we need to carefully consider this, have some long discussions about it. This is not an attempt at a consensus tonight or anything like a consensus tonight. This is a good conceptualization of a lot of hard work done over the last year by the Interim Commission and others. But when we look at all the different plans coming forward, we have to have a framework to bring those issues, those principles, the other plans together in one place. This is one possible way of doing that. This or some iteration of this, we must come to some agreement sooner or later here about what this structure is going to look like. Many of us have felt rather frustrated over the first 4 or 5 weeks of this session that we continue to just talk and talk and talk about what's wrong with the system and look at some possible solutions. But this is the first real step towards looking at some real structure. And there'll be something for everyone to like in this and for something for everybody to dislike in this. But this is the beginning of the real discussion of what this committee, I believe, is going to do over the next several months. So with that sort of conceptual idea of the conception, let's get started and really start putting some meat in the bones if we can. Thank
well,
you,
and
Chair.
What we're looking for from the committee is as we go forward here, we're not just inviting hand grenades, we're inviting constructive comments and comments on things you like that you like and you don't like. I mean, it's that simple. Let's start building this delivery system, this structure, this framework, you know, one brick at a time. First bricks usually begin with money.
Computer terminal.
And
all my bills.
This is how we envision funding the Oregon Health Fund. You know, four major components. Number one, the money is pooled from three in-state sources, employer contributions, employee and individuals, and certainly public general funds, and then maximizing federal dollars from out of state, or obviously from the feds. What we have envisioned as we go forward, and I don't want to get too strategic here, I think the state of Oregon is entitled to make two requests to the federal government. One is to ask for the federal government to bring us up just to the national average in Medicare reimbursement rates. I would put about an additional $1 billion to $1.2 billion into Oregon health care. Short of that, which I acknowledge on their part is a very difficult thing, the equity argument is if you can't do that, well, then treat us fairly by at least allowing us a not just higher but much higher federal poverty level reimbursement level. Comments? Critiques?
I can make a little more of a comment if I could, Mr. Chair. On the likelihood of getting matching funds at a higher level for what we call a Medicaid program, we need to make this clear. This goes into a fund. And we're not talking about subsidizing families at 40% of the federal poverty level. We're talking about bringing federal dollars matched to this fund into that general pool. So people will be basically individually blinded by where that money comes or goes to. And they'll be buying into programs that already exist. Remember that the employers and employees in this state right now are already paying a huge cost shift into the Medicaid program and into the uninsured program. We're trying to end that cost shift both with our own dollars and federal match dollars. So if you think of it conceptually a little differently, then we're going to give a subsidy to a family at 400% or 300% of the federal poverty level. Think more, we're going to properly fund a pool where the benefit's going to go primarily to people who are already working and do not have health care. This is the best way to fund that pool with the least impact on employers and employees. But we blinded in that pool. So they get the card. We'll talk about that later. But we blinded in that pool. So you're not seeing a situation where you're having huge subsidies to families that are at a fairly high level of income. But they are the ones that are paying this cost shift. And we don't want that to go on.
Or to say that in a lot shorter, a lot fewer words, Massachusetts, there's been a great deal of press over their universal coverage plan. It's made all the easier in Massachusetts because they get round numbers, as we all know, double the Medicare reimbursement rate that we do, to the extent that Medicare is the preferred payer in the state of Massachusetts and actually subsidizes commercial insurance.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Frank.
Did I understand, Mr. Chair, that Medicare is not included in the federal matching funds at this point, at least even conceptually?
Correct. Yeah, there's no match on Medicare is a straight entitlement from the federal government.
Right, yeah.
There's no state, federal, there's no match from state dollars or personal dollars into the Medicare program. Now, in our particular state, a lot of people have to pay a premium for the Medicare. They have to pay copays for the Medicare. If you're in Massachusetts, there's no premium, no copay. At least there wasn't when I was back there. It may have changed because they have so much money pouring into the Medicare plan that they don't have to have individual contributions to it. Okay, and that may have changed since I was there, and Mitch, you may know better than I do now.
Well, and I understand where you're going with your point, but if you subscribe to the theory, which I think most of us do, that all health care is paid for through cost shift, huge amounts of Medicare dollars pouring into the Massachusetts system helps subsidize the rest of the system.
In this state, it's just the opposite.
And we're just the opposite.
So if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, we would be better off if we did not include Medicare in this program at this point because of that?
I think at this juncture, what we need to focus on is what we can have some control over, and is, and that would be our Medicaid population. But we will still ask. There's no harm in asking.
The best possible outcome, the feds say to us, we'll give you, as the chair just said, we'll give you the average Medicare rate across the country for the state of Oregon. I would say, hallelujah, we're done, I'm out of here, I'm going home. Okay? The likelihood of that happening is somewhat limited, I would say.
Well, let me caution that joyful outcome would be wonderful, but we're, as we've often stated, not going to just solve this with additional money. I mean, we need, you know, all the efficiencies and reallocation and proper application of existing dollars, because if we can't reduce costs, you can't throw enough money at this system.
Well,
thank you.
I think we have to try to get an equalization of the Medicare funding. I mean, that's a no-brainer, and if we're not working on that now, we certainly should be, and that's probably what part of Kisover's plan, but we need to hammer our congressional delegation for equity in that plan. I mean, I'm sure there was a reason for doing it originally, because we were better off than they were, and they were bringing up the... I don't know what the original reason for the disproportional...
I'll go through it someday with
well,
you.
But it
was never a good deal in the first
no,
place.
No, but I think it's time to end it. I think we should make that a priority. Not, you know, it doesn't have to be an integral part. Well, it should be an integral part, but we need to talk about it with our congressional delegation. That's
it wasn't that great a deal to begin with. Over the years, it is growing worse. Because we started off at a lower reimbursement rate, and everyone got the same amount of increase year after year, 5, 7, 9, 2, whatever it was, just time value of money, over 40 years.
Yeah.
The discrepancy has grown significant and meaningful and very hurtful.
Ridiculous.
We've been arguing with the congressional delegation since 1977.
Okay.
But we'll not stop. We'll continue.
Actually, it didn't start until 1980. But I want to ask two questions. One is on the Medicare. Are you talking about the AAPCC rate that's paid for prepaid Medicare, or are you talking about the fee-for-service schedule?
Right now we're talking about fee-for-service. The risk models might be a little better for us, I've been told.
I understand why the prepaid rate is lower. The basic notion is you would pay some proportion of the rate that would be covered if people weren't in prepayment, if they were in the fee-for-service. But is there a difference in the fee-for-service fee schedule for Medicare state by state? I don't think so.
I don't believe so. But I know that my understanding is that not the RVUs are different, but the conversion rates are different in the at-risk models, and that's the one we have to get into.
Yes, in the at-risk models. I mean, when we started the Medicare at-risk models in 1980, Oregon had about 28 days per 1,000 hospital use, and the East Coast had 4,500 days. So when you converted that into a risk contract, we simply were being paid based on the medical care patterns of the state in the risk contracts, which must be what, about 70% of the.
So it's the vast. It's the majority of the market now. I know that.
But the underlying phenomenon is, as long as our fee for service world is less, then the at risk premiums should be less as well. And I suppose the only way we could deal with this is if we bumped up our fee for service utilization and changed the patterns of the. Of the state. I mean, it's going to be hard to change the basic concept of.
And you really don't want to do that. You know, what you're doing is talking about churning patients or raising your rates when, in fact, we're trying to do cost control and they don't allow us to. It's the old story of no good deed going unpunished, as we all know. Oregon, Washington, California, especially Oregon, Washington, have had pretty good utilization rates, and they're being penalized for that.
The variable you left out of that soliloquy, Mitch, was with the same or better outcomes on the West Coast.
Yeah. Somebody's phone's going crazy here. Is that?
Not me.
Can I ask a second question about this? That employer contribution, is that the concept that basically everything employers in the state pay for health care would be put into the Oregon Health Fund?
Define everything. No, not necessarily.
It would be some subset of what employers pay for health care. But it would be, it would include the private premiums that employers pay for health care. Rather than going to their insurance company or their fee-for-service, I mean their self-insured plan, would go into the fund? Is that the basic notion?
Right.
I mean, roughly?
The way we perceive this is if you're a self-insured employer, you are exempt from any employer contributions as long as you're not cost-shifting. As an example, if you're Fred Meyer, who has strong self-insurance programs and are not cost-shifting, you'd be exempt from this. If you're another big box store and you're only paying for your top executives that have some health insurance and the vast majority of your employees have no health insurance, you'd be asked to make a contribution to the pool because you're cost-shifting those employees to the rest of the market.
Well, maybe I need to go further when we keep talking, but my assumption is that the money was intended to come out of the health fund to pay for health insurance for all the people in the state. Or something like
all those who are uninsured.
All those who are uninsured.
About 25% of the market right now, give or take a percentage point, are self-insured in programs, and usually large companies that are self-insured and are well taken care of for the most part.
So what's down at the other end of this, which we'll get to soon?
We'll get to it soon.
Is only people who are currently uninsured, not people who are currently insured.
It could include the people who are insured also.
And I think it's actually...
We'll wait till we get...
Yeah.
But because of ERISA, the uninsured, the self-insured are clearly out. There's federal employees involved in this, of course, who would probably be exempt also. They're also insured.
Bill, did you have a question?
No.
Yeah. A couple, Mr. Chair. In the terminology, I'm sure of that, but we're talking about the federal pot. Number one is being federal matching funds. As long as we're still matching, we're still in the same box, in my opinion. I think there's an aggressive waiver request in the offing here.
Yes.
And it should be more of a block grant so that we have the flexibility we need. I would also suggest that I know it's a steeper hill to climb because it'd take an act of Congress to do something similar with Medicare.
Right.
But I think it would be informative to have a discussion with Senator Wyden, who has a similar plan, as to whether he'd be willing to be the champion for us of that sort of legislative proposal. And I think we need to have those conversations relatively soon. Another question at this point would be, when we look at the three pots of money from inside the state, are we assuming that state employees are part of the system? So to a degree, PEB as we know it will become a thing of the past.
I don't know if PEB as we know it, I mean, we've got to refine that as we go through, but the whole goal here, principles of pooling, is to create as large a pool as we possibly can. And the first principle of that is that if you're cost shifting, if you're not cost shifting, you know, we're not as concerned about that entity, group, organization, as we are if you are cost shifting.
Okay, but I would suggest, I mean, if we're looking at how this is appropriately funded, the PEB benefit is an incredibly rich benefit. There's a hell of a lot of money there. And if they go into this pool and everything outside of catastrophic that's currently allocated, that's a significant chunk of change into this pot.
I would offer that they are a good example of what we mean by buy-up. Okay, as we get through this, you'll see an essential benefit package, and mm-hmm. any one of these groups potentially could buy up, and you might well find that the PEB pool is one that's buying up. And that would be a discussion with PEB and the unions and all those people who are involved in that.
Okay.
But the PEB benefit was not necessarily going to be the benefit from the Oregon Health Fund.
Well, hopefully not. Okay. But
I'm not sure I answered your question. I'm sorry.
But the point being is, as I understand the buy-up concept, is this plan will provide this basic health benefit pot of money and catastrophic coverage, and the buy-up is going to be more or less at the individual level.
Depending what program they buy into, and then we have a larger discussion to go on what the essential package looks like, what buy-ups are available.
Absolutely do.
Do you make those buy-ups available to them? Do you use HSAs, HRAs, straight funding? Those things are things we have to flesh out.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And we want those things.
The costs are going to continue. The unions are not going to be able to negotiate the same rich contracts over time as they have now. There will be a natural transition, I believe, into a program like this. The unions have to agree to it, first of all.
Yeah.
And I could see where the employers would make a contribution, the workers would, the unions, workers, members, which I was at one point, would make a contribution for a package which is not perfect, but would satisfy their needs. And then there's nothing to prevent, I don't think, the unions from negotiating with a particular employer for something more if the employer goes along with it, and some may. I'm talking about public or even private. And I'm hoping that the same insurers will be involved. I mean, we can't tear everything apart. We have to work with what's there.
Yep.
So I think this is going to be a natural transition as health care becomes more and more and more prohibitive, that it will just transition into a new system.
You guys are anticipating a lot of what's on the next slides. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I want to give you an anecdotal example. Alan and I went to speak to the AFL-CIO, and we're speaking, and we're talking, outline this basic plan without the graphics, it's hard to get with the graphics. But we were getting a lot of this. And I just happened to think, you know, do we have any Taft-Hartley benefit managers here? And about four hands went up. And I went, oh, whew. I said, you know, isn't it basically your challenge that your costs are going up, your benefits are going down, those lines intersected a long time ago, and the gap is widening, and they're all going like this? And then the hands kind of went down, and they started leaning into the conversation a little bit. And I made this point. And that was, you know, I'm blessed with health insurance. You're blessed with health insurance. I don't care what we think we've got today. We've got nothing at all. And this is to Bill's point, because this is not sustainable. We can, you know, hold on to our little raft, you know, in the stormy sea, and unquestionably be swept away with the tide if we're all not willing to help preserve all of our health care. We've all got great risk if we don't act collectively. And then with regard to your earlier comment about Wyden, Alan and I have had the opportunity to sit down not only with Senator Wyden, whose plan is really designed to encourage states to come up with models. I mean, there are waiver holes in that thing big enough to drive a bus through. And I don't know this, Jeff, but I think that's really where the feds are hoping the states will lead, come up with some different models to work on a statewide basis as a pilot to see what works. Because if they try to come up, and you know what, it's probably three or four different models that can work. But I think they are very reluctant to come up with a top-down, one-size-fits-all, back into a Medicaid-type system. And I know there's one person on this committee that has spent more time writing waivers than anyone else, and that's you.
And you're right about Medicare. Medicare has to change, too. And the federal government last fall did something I just became aware of about 6 weeks ago. It surprised me, but made me understand that they realize the problems out there. Basic Medicare rates were set by RVUs, put in the Federal Registry, I think, every year. And physicians have all been very concerned about a cut in RVUs and cut in funding to Part B for Medicare, which affects their income. And the story is that we're going to have a cut this year. But if you look carefully what they did, the cuts were not uniform. There was a cut in specialty care and an increase in primary care. And that speaks to a system that needs to change. And they understand that. They're trying to, I believe, give us some messages here that they can work with us. And I appreciate that.
Well, they need to, but their self-destructing Part D was a mistake, in my opinion.
I agree.
Well, I mean, you know, it's yeah, okay, we don't need to go there, but I personally think that the feds would like us to relieve them of the entire burden if we can come up with a system that will work, which is why I think we need to look at both Medicare and Medicaid, because neither one is long-term sustainable at the federal level. And they know that. They finally are starting to actually realize that. So I think the time is now for us to be very, very aggressive in what we're seeking.
I'm writing that down, and I'm going to hold you to that. Any other questions on funding?
Senator, if I may, you made a comment that you're looking for the largest pool that you can create. And when you talk about large pools, I guess I'm looking for the smallest pool I can create, because it create for me, what that means is, when I'm in a small pool, that I'm more influenced by my cohort to not overutilize the system. And the larger the pool, the less incentive I have to not utilize the system. And so, if you can, I mean, what we're creating here is we're distancing the patient from the cost of the service. The further away, the larger the pool is, further away they get from that cost. And so if you can create a mechanism to cover catastrophic care in the large pool, but yet bring smaller pools closer to the primary care and to the direct impact, then I would say you might have a way to influence cost.
Go ahead, but you can see individual and employee contributions there. Mm-hmm. This isn't just, here's your card, free access. I mean, there's got to be individual cost, responsibility, and sharing. So I think that's how we get at it. But
you hit on a key point, and I appreciate your comment, because when we talk about this, that's one thing that came up over and over again. Individual employees have to put into it, and individuals have to put into it. They may well get the card, which will buy them into a larger plan, but that larger plan isn't the whole pool. And we'll see how that breaks down later. Okay, so they'll have choices of going into various smaller pools that may be better for them or worse for them, depending on how well that pool is managed. That's where the rubber meets the road for the individual, I believe. You know, they'll have some options there that says, hey, you want in a pool with an HSA? Great. You may have a little shrink your benefit plan, but you buy it at HSA, now you've got some responsibility in this thing. What are your co-pays for this pool? What are your benefits for this pool? So I agree, just one massive fund would not do this. Then you're into socialized medicine, then you're into a single-payer system. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about that, because then there's no sense of responsibility for the individual. And without that sense of responsibility by the individual, the providers, and the insurers, we'll never get cost control. You're absolutely correct.
If you get all the way over to the other side of the graphic, you see the AHPs, and that's where you're well taken point.
Graphics are absolutely correct.
Yeah, well, I do want to comment. I mean, we're not talking about socialized medicine anywhere here because we're not talking about taking over the healthcare system, which is socialized medicine. But what we ought to be talking about is social insurance. It would seem to me the question of small pools are fine and having skin in the game are fine unless you create a rating system that makes it advantageous for the good risk to go into pools with lower costs and lower premiums, forcing the high risks into pools that have very high premiums and making it very difficult. I mean, we don't want to bifurcate the market. It's fine to have different models and different approaches, but it seems to me we ought to be thinking seriously about the concept of community rating these things to create the social insurance responsibility that I think we're trying to talk about here.
When we talked about the AHP, Mr. Chair, if I can, when we talked about the AHPs, we talked about that very issue. Do you rate at the level of the individual or at the AHP level? We felt it's much more effective to rate at the AHP level, that they would be rated by the pool they have and the risk they have, and that way they wouldn't be what we call, as you well know, cherry-pick the market. We don't want that to happen. We want, as you've just said, social insurance.
We want to risk-adjust, but we want to start with a common basis, of course.
Right. You can't turn a car down, but you get risk-adjusted for it. We also know that there's a certain size you have to get to really get as most efficiency you can from administrating these plans. And you're probably talking a pretty good size, close to 100,000 lives before you get really where your most efficiency is. But you get too big, what Representative Maurer talked about, you sort of lose everything again, too. So it has to be some mixture there.
And I can tell two things. One, we should have started this discussion several weeks ago. Based on the excellent and articulate questions. And two, we're going to have to rush through this to do justice to our witnesses or our invited testimony, one individual who has come a great deal of distance. So let's pop to number two.
Can I also offer that on Wednesday we're going to spend the entire evening on this in a roundtable discussion, face-to-face, not at a dais, and we'll really get into it. So maybe we can let Rick run through it. You can think about it the next couple of days and then come back, and we can really have a great discussion.
And just public announcement, we're going to be meeting in hearing room 50. Is that correct? Wednesday night we will be in 50. So mark that on your calendars. Consider it.
Is that a good luck token? Back to the scene of the crime?
50's been a good room for us.
Yeah. Oregon Health Fund, all the funds collected from the different sources go in to provide, with the exceptions we've talked about, every Oregonian an Oregon health card. The key phrase there are the last three words, ensuring universal coverage. Any questions on that?
And we'll discuss eligible Oregonians Wednesday.
Excuse me, Jerry, did you want to mention the Health Fund Board and this one as well?
Yeah, this is where we have an oversight board that helps really put sideboards on the whole thing, that helps ensure that markets can work effectively. This is where we get transparency and certificate of need. This is what allows a market to compete on level playing fields. We're not trying to discourage competition in the least. We feel competition has a significant role to play in lowering costs. But it's got to be able to compete on a level playing field.
The makeup of this board, its responsibilities, its powers are one of the keys to this plan. It might be taking things on as broad as medical malpractice. Funded properly, all the issues you could think of that might be affecting this cloth they're trying to weave, but much of this could come out of this board, and that'll be a long discussion about what this board looks like and what it can actually do and not do.
It's interesting, and I understand this completely. We start talking about the board, and everyone wants a seat at the table, and while that is a very, very, very important issue that has to be addressed fairly and equitably, I think the structure of the board is just as if not more important in terms of how it operates and how it looks. We want to depoliticize it as much as possible. Several suggestions have been made to us by very thoughtful people of adopting a Federal Reserve model where you have a major, the major board located, pick a, Portland or Salem or Eugene, and then you have, as the Fed has, regional boards, regional feds, that would reflect geographic interests, 6-7 different, I think the Oregonian has 9 different Oregons, healthcare needs. I think we can address Senator Morsett's issues in that type of format on his passionate advocacy for rural health care versus different needs in urban health care. So there's some real flexibility that we can create into this, and I think it's a key to any eventual success that we all seek. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out there. Next slide, please. Any questions on that?
I'm sure everybody's willing to recognize that not everybody can be on the board, just so they can be on the board.
The board will be a paid board, right?
We see it as a operating as a legitimate board with a significant staff underneath it.
I'm reading the statute on the board, and we can talk about that.
That may well change dramatically.
Right.
Okay. We put some placeholders in that in 329. Yeah. We had to get something out of LC for people to push against. That's been a big debate, too.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Yeah, that's where we've got to sit around in a circle, eyeball to eyeball, in a public setting.
Yeah. And talk this through.
Why don't you take...
This is one way the money flows out of the central fund is people get a Oregon Health Card, and I would point out that everyone at the last meeting, the commission got an Oregon Health Card. It wasn't worth much, but they got one anyway. And they are directed to accountable health plans. Now, there would be people who are excluded from this. Obviously, if you're self-insured, you wouldn't be getting an Oregon Health Card if you're a self-insured company, but others would. And they can use that card to buy into an accountable health plan, either at the direction of their company, through their company, or individually. And how that exactly plays out has to be very carefully spelled out yet, but that's the basic concept. The accountable health plans are many of the plans we have now. These are the basic insurance companies we have already. You might see others grow up from this as it becomes available to them. The FCHIPs might change. That's a fully capitated health plans might change somewhat. But this would be the ones who actually administer the monies. Those accountable health plans are accountable to the board, as well as to the individual bringing the cards to them. And I think the real thing here is that the board has to put side railings on what those kind of health plans do and don't do. They'd have an opportunity to offer people the card buy-ups, hopefully offer them HSAs, offer them not so much a benefit change, because we want to sort of a general platform here that people can quickly and easily understand that is, as we say, a program that is understandable to people buying into it, but they might offer different deductibles, different co-pays. In many ways, those plans already can do that now, but for many of us, when you look at these plans, it's very difficult to understand what that basic benefit package they're offering is. We want to create a level playing field for that. And the other thing happens here is we talk about putting competition to the market. I still claim there's not a great deal of competition in this market by its nature or third-party payers. It just isn't there. We're hoping to develop real competition amongst the accountable health plans, so they really are competing for these cards in a way that we can help drive down costs.
And I would add that there's nothing in this that is exclusionary to a concept I'm becoming more intrigued with, which is the insurance exchange concept. I think that helps foster competition, transparency, particularly among our existing insurance providers. I think that's a tenet of both the Oregon Business Council plan and, correct me if I'm wrong, Mitch, the Oregon Health Policy Commission.
Yeah, whatever it's called. It's something.
Yeah.
A connector would fit in right here, probably, connecting these people to the right plans.
pretty simple. The Health Fund Board, as we've already discussed, ensures, you know, many of the cost reduction things that we all know, you know, are so overdue and necessary. They sent, you know, benefits package. It's kind of the guts of the whole package. The that flows from there back to then the actual provider, the hospital, the doctors, the clinic. Again, with sideboards put on from the Oregon Health Fund Board. That's really part of the guts of the whole proposal, Ron. This is what gets to your individual question about, you know, some individual responsibility. You got anything to add?
Nope. Thank you. You did a very good job.
Excuse me. The one thing I see there's somewhat of a conflict, maybe Representative Greenlee can clear this up, is when you start bringing individual responsibility, and then you say, but we have to be equal to everybody, and so that you don't end up you have a group of cherry pickers and a group of, you know, of watermelon layers, you know, I mean, potato pickers, right. But that's how you want to encourage people to be healthy so that they can get in this lower cost plan, because they know that you know, if I'm healthy and my activity warrants a lower cost, then I should not pay as much. And I see a conflict there.
But the issue is this: there's the payment at two levels. If you're young and healthy, you may not want to be paying as much for health insurance as when you're old and frail. But one idea is I pay a little more when I'm young and healthy, and I'm cost shifting across my lifetime, so that everybody doesn't bear the same cost at the time that, you know, that they have a whole lifetime. I've paid health insurance premiums my whole life. 50 years I've been paying health insurance premiums, and I've been paying them at a community rate. In the last 2 years I've used $250,000 worth of care. Should my health insurance at this point cost $250,000 a year because I'm at high risk now, or should I have been risk pooling that for myself over my whole lifetime? So one model is, well, Lori here is young and healthy. She pays $50 a month, and I pay $10,000 a month for my health insurance. Certainly, nobody would suggest that, but it's somewhere in the middle. But the point I was making about risk-adjusted community rating is about the health insurance plans, not about the individual. If I create a health insurance plan that by its design only draws young and healthy people, and there's another health insurance plan that by its design draws frail and elderly people because that's who they want to take care of, the money that goes to those two health insurance plans shouldn't be equal. We should be saying, you want to take care of young and healthy people, that's fine, but we'll risk adjust the money we give you to do it.
Okay.
And you want to take care of old and frail people, that's fine, but we'll give you more money to take care of the old and frail people because they're higher risk. So it's the difference between the individual risk and the risk at the health plan level.
Okay.
And there's another little piece to this, too, that I think, Mitch, thank you. You did a great explanation, and I appreciate that. You did a better job. But I know what you're trying to say. You said it better than I could by far. The other piece you're trying to get to, I think, is there is some personal involvement. Bad things happen to people who have done things right all their life.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some bad things that happen to people who have made some poor health decisions. They've continued to smoke, whatever you want to pick, okay? And we're trying to build something in here that also rewards people who have done the right thing, that have worked hard to take care of themselves. And that means things like HSAs and co-pays for certain things that would cost you more. If you've got COPD and emphysema from smoking, you're going to be going to the doctor a lot more because of your choices there. You should be paying those co-pays. Things of that nature is what we're still looking at. So you try to get to the individual to try to generate in them, you know, the right thing to do in their personal health habits. Now, that's the other issue you're concerned about, and I am too.
Okay.
We want to charge skiers and people that play racquetball a lot more.
I take first blood. I think we need to talk that one over a little bit. Some of us feel a little tight about it.
Blazer fans?
No. Yeah, people that go to Blazer games.
Particularly.
The other thing, Ron, is, you know, we're not trying to preclude what I want to call elective-type surgeries. But if you want those, you're going to pay individually a much higher percentage out of your own pocket than out of any collective fund. Not like we're trying to discourage them. Can't say you can't do it. Can't say you can't go out and buy a policy that, you know, provides for that type of service, either do it on a fee-for-service or an insurance basis. But it's not, like I say, we're trying to incent certain behaviors. And if you want other types of procedures, be our guest, but by golly, don't expect us to pay for it.
I'll take this last slide real quickly, if I could, Mr.
Chair. Yeah, because I'm going to have to
get out now. You got another meeting to go to. This is a real, you know, I've said over and over again, and you probably get tired of hearing this, that we're weaving a cloth here, and this is just one of the threads of a cloth. This is a different kind of connection between the payers and the providers. We're used to running with 26 different insurance companies, all looking at different things, well, with good intentions, all different kinds of forms. We can streamline the forms here to save money. We can also do something I think it's really important with this board as an oversight and going to the accountable health plans. We can start setting up things that really get down to outcome-based practices. We had a touch of that the other day in this committee. We talked about why is one part of the state significantly different than another part of the state in the amount of days in the ICU. There's no logical reason for that. Why do you get if you have prostate cancer in one part of the state, you get a prostatectomy, and the other one you get radium implants. There's no logic to that. So you can start using this system here to have a way of talking to providers about using outcome-based practices. And that's a very serious conversation. I got a letter the other day from a large insurer saying, I want you to check all your patients for their diabetes on a certain test called the glycohemoglobin A1C. The parameters for that test I thought were ridiculously high. They were very low standards. I get one from the next insurance company, the number is different. That's the kind of things we have to change so that the providers have a clear idea of what they're supposed to be providing. You know, straightforward, straight up. There's 10 or 15 issues you can actually tackle in this way. Now, will providers jump and be happy to do this? Probably not. They'll be told that you have to meet certain criteria, but those criteria are outcome-based and reasonable to do. And I think in the long run, those things start to happen. So that connection here, I think, is very important. And that's another piece we have to talk about in depth.
And I want to apologize to the committee, and particularly Jody and Jacqueline. I've got to exit, so I will hand the gavel over to my able co-chair. And I'm very much looking forward to our continued discussion of this on Wednesday in a more intimate public setting.
And I want to thank the committee for letting us kind of rush through those last slides. We will dice, slice, and dissect them very carefully with all kinds of questions, I hope, on Wednesday, and I really want to generate questions and really take this thing apart and put it back together for us. That's really important with here. I had good questions tonight. I hope we'll continue to do that. Rick, you want to come back up here and join me? And audience members, I want to thank you for kind of hanging us in there with us. I know we have a couple of people from outside the area who we've put off until 6 o'clock, and I appreciate your patience. So the first individual up, I believe, is electronic health records with Jody Pettit. And Jody, if you'd come up and introduce yourself, and we'll get started.
Chair Bates, Vice Chair Winters, I guess is the word. and members of the Senate Health Reform Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. My name is Jody Pettit. I've been a practicing internist in Oregon for 12 years, and I'm working now at the state of Oregon as a part-time contractor to the Office of Health Policy and Research, doing health information technology coordination. In part of that role, I serve as the project director for the Oregon Health Information Security and Privacy Collaboration, and I'm an active member of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation and working with a team on the Portland Metro Health Information Exchange project with the Oregon Business Council. I'm going to quickly frame the issue, but I'm going to spend most of this 10 minutes on proposed solutions. And I will say that they are in harmony with the Oregon Health Policy Commission's recommendations for the development of widespread and shared electronic health records. My remarks will center on two major themes. One is portability, and the other, privacy of Oregonians' health information. And it's going to take the form of six questions, kind of like a FAQ, frequently asked questions. Number one, what is the rationale for the use of health information technology? And that is to practice preventive care, acute care, and chronic care, both at individual and population levels. Tracking is what computers do really well, so let's allow computers to do that, what they're good at, and give us more time for the human element to listen, to diagnose, to problem solve, and to explain, rather than gather data, enter data, and track data. I think this committee is well-versed in how information technology can help improve quality and efficiency, but I'll just highlight a couple things. It will help providers have the information they need to make decisions. It will reduce redundant work and testing, prevent errors, help patients become more engaged in their care, and help in the surveillance of public health threats and enable healthcare research. What is the vision for health information technology? That an independent electronic personal health record would be available to every Oregonian so that their information is available anytime, anywhere for their care. Some of the sources of health information would be from health systems, physician and clinician offices, health insurance plans, and from the individuals themselves. What is the role of the personal health record? The rise of the personal electronic independent personal health record represents an essential element of change that is expected to improve the health of individuals as well as the delivery of health care. These records would not replace the records of institutions, but would rather represent a collated copy of the individual's records from various sources. A personal health record would be expected to offer a rich and ever-evolving set of features and functions, including decision support not only for the clinician, but for the individual, to provide evidence-based information about medications, devices, and other treatments. You could have alerts and reminders for preventive services, public health concerns, and other condition-specific information. The availability of this record should improve the continuity of care, better engage and inform the individual, reduce rework, and reduce unnecessary health care expenditure, and it should be safer and higher quality care. You know all that, I think. So what has been done and is being done in Oregon? First, in terms of portability, I'm really excited to announce that we've done an assessment of electronic health record adoption in this state, and it is much, much higher than in other than the national average. And I'll direct you to the slide. Oh, I want to give credit here to the many people that worked on this inventory for 2006. Tina Edlund is here with us tonight and really made this come together. But we estimate that 59% of ambulatory physicians in Oregon have or are currently implementing an electronic health record. So there's also a clear trend that these tend to be larger clinics. So you'll see the association here that the clinics that are associated with health systems have adopted, and generally the smaller clinics remain on paper records. And here's just a couple more things you might find of interest, that a couple of electronic health record vendors tend to dominate the Oregon market, and that we have some information on intent to invest in the near future. Mm-hmm. The two things that were associated with not investing were the expense and then the satisfaction with the status quo. Yes.
Did you survey by age? Are the older ones the ones that aren't wanting to go?
No, actually, we didn't in this particular survey. Right?
I know it's been a real struggle for Dr. Bates to go electronic.
I would offer that that is age discrimination, however relevant it might be and true. It's clearly age discrimination. And I will tell you that I have committed through my IPA that when I return in June, that we will start implementing an EPIC system in our office.
Since you're handicapped, I assume that they'll make reasonable accommodations.
Yeah, they're going to hire a 10-year-old to help me out.
Was this survey only done in physician offices?
We included MDs, DOs, NPs, and PAs.
Thank you.
And so here's our slide to brag that we're way above the national estimate. And there was a national estimate was recently done by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation just in November of 06. So this is a very recent number from that standpoint. Also going on in Oregon, all around the state, communities are working on health information exchange. Bend, Coos Bay, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, Lane County, Lincoln City, Medford, Portland, Roseburg, and Salem, and perhaps others. But these projects are working on scant funding, time-limited federal grants, and formation of governance has been slow in most places. State tours and statewide conferences have been conducted and will be conducted, and actually these communities are very excited to come forth and talk about the work that they're doing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Jody, do you know offhand what proportion of all practices are included at Kaiser, Providence, VA, and OHSU?
We did pull them out separately. I don't think I could tell you off the top of my head, but they account for a great deal of this EHR adoption, definitely.
Those four institutions.
Yeah. Yes, sir. And OHSU hasn't completely adopted EPIC, but I spoke with their president, Joe Robertson, and he said, you can bet at, I think, $70 million were committed. So we counted that.
Yeah, they're doing it practice at a time.
Dr. Pettit, just a question. How well do these systems talk to each other? For instance, in my particular office, we are really enjoying the ability to go into a record at a hospital. We can pull up all the lab, all the consults, all the radiology work that was done on that patient, discharge and summary and H&P, and encounters the emergency room. It's just a magical thing for us to have this after 30 years in healthcare. But if I go to a different hospital, I can't do that. And if I go to someone else's practice, I can't do that yet. How well are these systems going to be able to talk to each other when we're through?
Chairman Bates, in answer to your first question, they don't communicate very well with each other at all unless in the circumstance that you mentioned, that's primarily because custom interfaces have been built, not because those computers talk in a common language. And so the ultimate goal here will be standards-based communication and interoperation. And hopefully within the next decade we'll achieve something like that. Right now, what you've seen is a very expensive proposition, and it's a point-to-point interface building, which isn't really a scalable way to go. Many health systems have been able to achieve that, or certain large clinics, but it's not scalable in the broad term.
Thank you, Doctor.
And I might also add that this is why, and just the way you mentioned it is right, that it's the person that's the constant in the healthcare system, and that part of the revolution here is to change from an institution-centric model to a person-centered model so that that information is with that person wherever they are.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was just thinking what you were talking about there with what we're doing on the education side of things, where we're trying to get everything connected and to where information can be transferred. And what we're doing there is rather than going out at the district level and trying to get them all in the same system, we are creating a system of you can call them warehouses or whatever, where the information goes into and is translated and then becomes transferable. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so I guess I'm just wondering if that would be a better way to go, rather, you know, with all these local systems have their own language, that we create centers where the translate, because it's just a bounce is all it is. So, I mean,
Doctor?
Chair and members of the committee, without getting into a technological discussion, there are centers of aggregation that can accomplish that sort of goal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ultimately that even a system in that way would still need to have standards in terms of nomenclature and messaging and I've escaped me right now, but a number of standards. Oh, I'm thinking of authentication and authorization to such a system. Mm-hmm. So the role of standards is still absolutely critical.
Well, yeah, Ms. Chair, I mean, they got to be reporting the same data, but you know, what we're looking at in our 197 school districts is about 7 or 8 different systems that are recording the data, and we are going to be setting up 10 centralized locations for data entry. It's going to cost us a whopping $10 million to do that. So, I mean, something like that is certainly more affordable than requiring all the districts to get something that's in the same language sort of thing. So, you know, just...
I think I understand the concept, and I'm no expert in electronic records.
No, nor am I. Trust me. I just told you all I know.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
I mean, the underlying assumption that Senator Cruz is really testing is the notion that you really do need an individual-centric model rather than a system-centric model. I mean, that notion is a system-centric model that puts the data into, for a better term, a data warehouse, and allows you to tap it for individuals when you need it. But it doesn't create, on an a priori basis, a separate record for every student in the state. It creates a way to get it for any student when you need it for that student. And I wonder, I mean, I really do wonder about the notion of the underlying assumption being that there needs to be a single individual record for every individual that is maintained and updated and current and on an ongoing basis, as opposed to having a way to gather information relevant for that individual at a time they need it, in an emergency room, when you want to do some prevention, I mean, a variety of things. And I think that's the assumption that I hear Senator Cruz testing. Can you comment on that just a bit?
And Chair and members of the committee, this is a wonderful point to bring up, and it's been a topic of philosophical discussions across the country. I would say this. I think there's two issues here. One is an architectural issue as to whether things exist in a singular database or whether they're in a distributed configuration and brought together virtually. That's one discussion, and I think that's going to get ironed out. It's more of a technical issue. But I think the second issue is about whether you really need to create a record for that person, a longitudinal record. And I think of it this way very simply. If someone had written a book about you, and they took the chapters of that book and they tore each chapter out and they sent it to different places, so now each health system has a different chapter in your life, you could call or electronically summon the information from OHSU or Legacy or Providence or Kaiser, but you're only going to get one chapter at a time.
Why? I mean, that's the assumption. I mean, if I show up at any one of those systems, there's no reason that you can't electronically create my book by going out wherever there's anywhere there's information about me and bringing it back at the time it's needed, or at least the subplots of the book that are necessary at that point. I mean, as you point out, it's only a technical problem. It's not all that hard.
Chair, then we're going back to, I'm sorry, the first part, which was whether you build it in a database or whether you have essentially electronic pointers to various databases and pull it together. And I think that I went to the Nationwide Health Information Network architecture demonstrations, and they showed hybrid models generally. So there's some data that's aggregated for population reporting and decision support, and then there are other parts of it that are exactly, as you say, distributed and pulled together virtually at the time they're needed.
I'm taking the chair's prerogative here and stop this, because we got another speaker to come in here later. I would say that in my personal life, I want those chapters all over the place. I don't want anyone reading all the chapters in my life. Okay? Well, go ahead. If you can finish up quickly, and I'm going to hold questions, and we'll get the next speaker up.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because you don't want people reading your records, and the next part I'm going to talk about is privacy. And so I mentioned the Health Information Security and Privacy Collaboration, and we've been working for 8 months to do an assessment of privacy and security requirements. And our findings to date indicate that federal law, HIPAA, the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, by itself is inadequate to protect people in the way that they expect, and that there may be, almost certainly will be, a role for state law in protecting people in the way that they want to be protected. A quick note about portability and privacy is that our Attorney General, Hardy Myers, has recently been accepted a seat on the Alliance for State eHealth, and he's one of seven voting members of this alliance made up of governors, insurance commissioners, and attorneys general, and will be working with other states across the nation. So what still needs to be done? We need to adopt standards. We need continued adoption of EHR with a special emphasis on smaller clinics and safety net clinics, including federally qualified health centers. And we could support models that support multiple clinics, such as service provider models that are maybe more financially and technically viable. Support for health information exchange projects at the community level, and also Medicaid is the second largest payer in the state, should be a part of these discussions and governance proposals in these various communities. We could support the adoption of independent personal health records and support high-speed electronic connectivity between communities in Oregon. Also support coordination efforts and help position Oregon for federal funding. There is more funding coming down the pike for this. The feds have told us that in a couple of different venues. So we want to do everything that we can to make sure that Oregon is included in that funding. We need to address these privacy and security requirements in a transition strategy between the way things are now and the way things could be. And we may need to consider working with other states on model legislation or uniform state laws. And specifically, I'll sort of jump to the back, but specifically with regard to certain issues such as patient consent, requiring non-covered entities under HIPAA to comply with federal and state law if they're handling personal health information. Some entities that have come up now, commercial entities handling health information. And provide for enforcement of privacy laws. Right now there isn't much in the way of privacy enforcement. And establish policies for secondary use of data. Many of the business models that people are looking at for health information exchange include the sale of health data, and so we need to make sure that people's privacy is protected in that circumstance. I did include a slide from the Marco Foundation Connecting for Health in here about the role of government in establishing protection. 75% of people in surveyed, and this was 1,000 people over the country, see a role for government in protecting their privacy. So in short, the state can provide leadership and protect privacy. The state can continue to influence the market as a purchaser, can continue with efforts as a payer through Medicaid. I think I've mentioned some of these other ones. So, in conclusion, there's a transformational change going on in terms of arrangement of health information flow in this country. We have to work through a transition from how it is now to how it will be. At present, the individual is standing on the outside looking in with regard to their health information. People in general are not aware of their rights with regard to federal and state privacy laws. Information is shared by providers, payers, and their business associates for payment, treatment, and healthcare operations without their consent, with some exceptions for specially protected information. There's still work to be done to protect people's privacy in a way that they expect it should be. The good news is that architecting health information exchange and protecting privacy go hand in hand. Choices about policy and technology necessarily shape each other. And to build trust, the policy decisions must come first. So we need to create policies and ensure that health information exchange is built with privacy protections. Finally, what looked like a blurry picture about 3 years ago is gradually materializing, and the patient standing in the middle of it. There are differences of opinion of various aspects, but it is clear that the new way will be patient-centered. And perhaps healthcare, a relative latecomer to information management, will ultimately do better than the other sectors that have preceded it. So that instead of requesting our medical records like we do the sporadic credit report to see what others have collected and see about us, we will have our health information at our fingertips and in our control. After all, it is of a most personal and deservedly private nature. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Pettit. Thank you for coming. And we'll probably be drawing you back here in the future. We want a little more time with you, and we're not quite so rushed.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming tonight and speaking to us. I believe, Jacqueline, you're next. Would you please step up here? And you're going to be introduced by, although we all, I think, know you pretty well, I'm going to have the good senator to my left here introduce you and your program.
Thank you, Jackie. I told you you wouldn't have 10 minutes. You've got four. And usually in committees we take the people who've traveled furthest, and she traveled 500 miles to be here today. So I think you ought to pay her airfare back.
Well, my watch stopped ticking at 6:15, so even that says that. Mine stopped at 6:15, so it's 6:15 at my clock. That's
well,
where we're going.
Well, anyway, for those of you who have not had the great fortune of having an introduction to this program, I think it's
way cool.
It is way cool.
And can be members, I'd ask
so
you.
So anyway, know. I'll go ahead and get started because... you can.
Thank you, Jackie. Just a second. Sure. Committee members, if you don't mind, I'd like to have us stay here while she has a chance to give her presentation. It'll run us about 10 minutes over, I expect, but if you can hold on there with me, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Jack.
That's fine. Thank you. I actually will be back in Oregon another time, so I'd be happy to come back. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I am Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm with Trilogy Integrated Resources Network of Care. And in the interest of time, I'll just kind of jump right into the site for you. But first, I want to applaud you because you are now the proud owner of a website called Network of Care for Seniors and People with Disabilities here in Oregon statewide. And you achieved this when we modernized Oregon Project Independence last session. One of the things that we were looking for was a tool to help people access services at the ground level as consumers. A number of people that need services in the state do not necessarily need a case manager. There isn't a case manager on every corner. And, in fact, even if you are a case manager, the waiting list in the senior and people with disability community was quite long. And so, at any rate, we were looking for a website to help people bridge that gap, and we found this fabulous website called Network of Care, and it was so good that many of you know I probably could have died in the job I had last session, and I nearly did. And this website was so fantastic. I saw that it really met that goal of giving consumers the knowledge that they needed to make informed choices without having to interact with local government or until they really needed to. And I thought it really did a beautiful job of doing that. So what I'm going to do in the interest of time is I'm going to show you that you do have a website for seniors and people with disabilities and point you to your various own websites. Since I've been up here a couple of times showing the site, a number of legislators have linked their own personal legislative websites to the Network of Care site as a tool for their consumers. They're also taking this website out into their own community, linking it with an in-focus projector and showing the 17-minute or so live demo for their community so that they're aware of this tool. And so if you don't happen to catch my act today, you can play it tomorrow. and run through the site. And I'm approaching your staffs as well, because I think you become sort of case managers by de facto here, by default, I mean, because you hear from your constituents all the time about things that are needed. I should have gone to Representative Morissette's site, but this is your home page, and I want you to know that we gave a nod this is Multnomah County's, but on the home page we give a nod to the legislature in Senate Bill 870, which was Senator Morissette's baby, which created the funding for the Network of Care website. So this is a very quick tour of the senior and disability site, and I'm going to show you very quickly the mental health site and the children and families site. The state's been very interested in obtaining the mental health site for some years now, and it appears that this is a year that it might happen. There's also interest on behalf of the on the part of the Commission on Children and Families to have the website for children and families here in Oregon. There's also some interest by some legislators in obtaining the domestic violence site. We also have a developmental disability site. Very quickly, the website was created by a legislator by the name of Bruce Bronson from the California Assembly. He was the chair of Human Services Ways and Means for 10 years, so he very much understood what you all understand as members of this and other health and wellness committees. It was created with a $2.5 million grant by Governor Gray Davis, who was looking for innovation in healthcare and healthcare reform, transportable systems that were innovative and helped people find services. What happened was this site was designed for consumers, and in the end is very much in use by case managers, care providers, and here in Oregon, about 4,000 to 6,000 unique individuals, are using this website every month. We don't know who they are, but we know how many there are. In fact, there are people from Japan who are using this website. There are no barriers to using this website anywhere unless you're into your personal folder. So anyone can access this at any time for free. And as we can see, many people are probably the equivalent of, I guess it's around 60,000 people a year or so. And it's a relatively new site. There is a service directory. Everything on our site is designed to be located within 3 to 5 clicks. There's no commercial activity anywhere on this site. There are no pop-ups. You're not going to win a computer if you log on to this site. It's strictly information only. There are several different ways to access information, and you could do it as simple as just putting in a keyword. So this is the service directory, and again, in the interest of time, I'd love to show it to you, but I don't think that I can. The library contains information primarily from HealthWise Knowledge Base and a number of other companies, but HealthWise Knowledge Base is a company that for years only provided information to the federal government and insurance companies. We are the first public company to have access to this information. There are 4,000 topics, 30,000 articles. It's 50,000 pages long, and it's updated 4 times a year. Unless something urgent or pressing has become public, and then we update immediately. But this particular website is designed to appeal to seniors and people with disabilities in its topics: thrive at home, fall prevention for caregivers, diseases, conditions, et cetera, et cetera. It's very fun to muck about in this particular site, you'll see that. It's laid out in each article is laid out in a fashion that perhaps you and I would encounter a particular diagnosis from our physician. What are the cause? What are the symptoms? What happens? What increases your risk? When do you call a doctor? And so on and so forth. I neglected to mention, yes.
Can I interrupt?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess what I would like you to talk about is how we coordinate within a given, this is a county program. We had a hearing and talked about Sweden. It was basically a small unit. Within a small unit, how can we find and coordinate all of the services within that unit?
That's a very good question.
Well, and see, this is the application that I think for this committee. We're trying to build a new system. This is the foundation of a new. This is one of the foundations of the new system, because within this program, we can find who's out there. Who do we have to involve?
That's correct.
Yeah, and so that's what I think is the relevance, and not so much explaining what a particular disease is. That's fine, but
right.
Who are the players?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morissette, that's what we've done with the service directories. We've integrated, we've taken and created a virtual community for people in each region of the state. There are 36 network of care sites for seniors and people with disabilities, and in each one of those sites is sort of a regional area where all services that pertain to their health conditions and their issues as seniors and people with disabilities or the mental health community or children and families is available to them in multiple languages, by the way. So it's similar to a building that's staffed 24 hours a day, fully staffed with people who speak multiple languages, who know that an individual's service needs don't just end at where do I find services, but where do I find information out about this particular condition, how do I stay in my own home, I don't know anything about assistive devices, what links are available for me, how can I connect to, there's 2,000 links in this particular website that are categorized that help people connect to other services that are available for them. You certainly don't stop looking just because you don't see something right in your immediate neighborhood. This has taken all of that information and put it in one convenient place. The number one source for information in the country is the Internet, so it's all done right here.
Senator Morrison, I think what you're trying to tell us here, and let me see if I've got this right. Patients in the physician's office, as an example, and we're looking at what we've talked about, a team approach to the care of the patient. That patient might need a housing problem. They might need help taking their medications. They might need a transportation issue dealt with. This website or one like it, maybe even an expanded one, would allow that team, that physician or one of the people on that team with him or her, to access something like this and start getting these people the wraparound services they want, not just a prescription and see me in 3 months.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, that is correct. I mean, if you look at the categories that we have up here, and by the way, Oregon selected these categories. They're relevant to Oregon. They're broad to begin with and designed for you to sort of drill down and get specific information about them. You can see, for example, you're looking on an aging disability website, but there might be an issue with home security for you. Here are 19 results of things that pertain to that particular issue. The other thing about this is that, I mean, here's community voicemail. I mean, that's an incredible service that's provided. If you happen to be homeless and you don't have a way for people to reach you and let you know that there's a job available for you and whatnot, there's their basic information very quickly. And if there's more detailed information for them, it's right here. And we also have an algorithm system here, so other things that may be useful to you. If you're in a position where you need help with just having a basic voicemail, you might need a food pantry or community shelters and such and so forth. It's all located in this one particular page. We also offer a more detailed site for people to access that very information that deals with fees. You can put on registration forms on here. You can speak to languages spoken. You can use our website to find something like this that may be within 250 miles of your house. I mean, it's just one way to search for things. You can search for services by language. It pretty much covers the gamut of information that a person would need if they're looking at. This site, again, was primarily designed for consumers, but it turned out that people of every... A case manager can only look for so many things. They can only look at the resource directory that's on their desk for you, and you don't even know if it's current. They certainly don't, as a general rule, wouldn't have time to look for 21,000 assistive devices for something for you, but it's very quickly done through here. The other thing I wanted to point out on this, because time is so short, and I hope I'm not missing key points, Senator Morissette, you'll let me know, I'm sure, but you can store anything that you're finding on this site in a folder, online folder, and it was interesting the previous speaker's comment. This particular online folder allows you to store all information that you're identifying throughout the site, and then you can it asks you if you'd like to create information like list all of your healthcare providers, all of your prescriptions, all of the any diseases that you've been diagnosed with. It's very simple to maintain a folder that has all of this information in there. In fact, in your medical history, if you were to state, for example, and this will show you, I have arthritis, right here integrated throughout the entire site is this button that says Learn More. And when you click on that, it goes back to the website and finds articles of interest in the field of arthritis. If you click Where to Find Help, it'll go back to the website and look for services for you that are available if you are suffering from arthritis. So it's integrated throughout. The other piece to this folder, and there are folder systems out there that's very unique, is that this particular folder, and I happen to be using this for my parents, is designed such that you can share any or all or some or none of this folder with trusted friends or caregivers or family members from this date to that date. You can share it with as many people as you want. And then by email, they'll get a message that says, this is important to me. I'm adding information into my personal folder, and I want you to be aware of that. So when you get the call and you end up taking mom to the hospital, you may not have all this in your head, but you can certainly open up a computer at the hospital and access all of this information. Or it may be something you print out and carry it around, but you can share the items of your choosing with the people of your choice as you're going through the website. That's pretty unique. One last little piece is in the legislate site. We're linked to every legislature in the nation, and all bills, or almost all bills that deal with seniors and people with disabilities, for example, are on this website. So I'm sorry for you, but people can communicate with you directly from this website very quickly. They could just send you an email and talk to you about how they feel about a bill, and they can email an entire committee all at once. But the nice thing about this folder is that, as advocates, we all know that whatever happens here is directly connected to how big this service directory is. And you can store any bill that you find on this bill that's important, or on the site that's important to you, in your folder, and when there's activity on the bill, you'll then get an email alerting you that it's time to wake up and get busy and take some action. Told you wouldn't like that.
Oh, cool.
So, but this is the Aging and Disability website. There's a mental health site that's named the model for the nation by the President's New Freedom Commission, endorsed by SAMHSA and NACBIT and such and so forth. And then, again, the Children and Families site are the ones that we have heard a significant interest in from this body.
Thank you for being succinct and quick.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You. Questions?
Great.
How's this
funded?
Senator Morse, this site, again, we crafted the Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act to help support a website for seniors and people with disabilities. The Department of Aging, Seniors, and People with Disabilities did fund this site in partnership with the Area Agencies on Aging last session. Someone's going to ask the money question, I assume. The site itself, again, this is now about a $3 million site. And if you built this from the ground up, that's about what it would cost. And again, we maintain everything on the site. We have the license for everything that's on here. The company charges a flat fee of about, we do it by population and region, but it's around $230,000 to actually acquire the site and load it. It takes about 90 days to launch a statewide. Governor Kulongowski launched our site for us last session. And then there's an ongoing maintenance cost, and that's, again, to keep the service directory active 24/7, maintain the fees for the library and such and so forth. Those maintenance fees run about the same. They're a little around $200,000 or so per year. That cost never goes up. That's something that we'll not incur roll-up costs on. It will go down at some point. We do give the state a break because you already have one site, and if we are familiar with your service directory, there's no reason for us to charge you more. I mean, there will be commonalities, so we do a discount for each site that you add on. But other than that, that's about how the cost works.
The bottom line is you're going to make our new health reform plan, and you're going to put it on this site. You're going to do all the schematics for us. You're going to come up here and show us how it all interacts. We will give you the pieces. The pieces are there. You put it together. Thank you very much, Chair.
Senator Morris,
that's a great offer that you
more than happy.
I'll see you next
week. We do customize this website extensively.
I'm serious.
We have added about $15,000 in upgrades and changes to the site as Oregon has emerged with their aging site, and we have not charged them for anything yet. So,
okay.
You need some help, let us know.
Well, you talk to the co-chair here. He'll tell you what.
I might do that.
Captain, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you, members.
One last question for you. The personal stuff, can a pulse form be put in that?
Excuse me?
Can a pulse form be put into the personal data file?
A pulse form?
That's the end of life directive.
Oh, yes, certainly. You can certainly. Yes, it's probably in here already.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions?
When are you going to come back?
Representative Maurer?
When I'm invited.
You're invited back anytime you want to come.
Thank you.
Is there a way to scan documents, PDF, create PDF documents?
There will soon be a way for you to scan documents and put them in. You can do that, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very
You're
much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Committee members, thank you for staying late night. We are adjourned.
Yeah, I'm going to go fishing, huh?
Yeah.
I think this is amazing.